Okay, today is August 8th, 2012. I'm Sarah Hunter-Laskowski. I'm here again with Hillary Domisch, and we're again interviewing Rolf Dessauer. And you had mentioned that you might have some interest in talking about the patent situation as related to Dialux, and I think we're interested in that too. In relation to this bigger issue of innovation, you know, what was really interesting about hearing about how this progressed, how your career was progressing, was there were obviously good things and bad things about the way in which you were able to bring this product along. So I was wondering if you could kind of speak about patents and kind of that sense of how it worked for you and how innovation can work there.
Okay. Well, I think one very important aspect of this technology was that we started very early to try to establish a strong patent position. And here we had compounds that were of interest. And actually, in the period from 1960 to about 1965, there were perhaps 10 or 20, I'll have to check exactly how many there were, publications that dealt with these very materials that we thought we had invented. But everybody was measuring properties, and nobody thought of doing any chemistry with them. The difference was simply that in the area of research, people were interested in how the color formed, how they discharged, and so on and so forth. We actually wanted to do some chemistry with these materials. Remember, we wanted to oxidize colorless forms of dyes to color, and we wanted to do polymerization and so on. So it was very important that we establish a good patent position. And at that time, searching for competitive patents was very much more difficult than it is now. Now you can go to the USPTO, the patent office website, and find a you put in a couple of names, and all of a sudden it searches and it comes out with tens or hundreds or thousands of patents that contain the term that you searched. But that was all before 1976. If you want to search any older patents, that's not so easy. Well, anyway, this was way back in the dark days of 1960, 61, 62. And physically what you had to do was you go to the patent office and you look into their stacks, and they had things fairly well organized, but you had to leaf through all the patents, and they find one that fit into what you were looking for, that you'd get a copy of that and study it in detail. Well, we found that nobody had ever applied for any patents on these materials, so that was good. And when we filed our first patent on biomidazole chemistry, or biomidazoles themselves, it was rejected. Most things were rejected when you apply for a patent. It's almost routine. But the examiner had said what you were doing had already been done a long time ago. Somebody had heated imidazoles, and they gave off light, so that nothing new there. And, well, I managed to write a reply to the patent office, and I said, well, this is like fireflies. You heat them and they give off light. That's one thing. We didn't heat anything. We shined light on it, and it gave off color, changed color. So I said, fireflies are not photochromic, and what we were doing was more like a salamander or an animal that changes color at will. So the examiner said that was, he accepted my argument, but he thought we needed to know to what the actual structure was. And because of the chemical construction of the biomidazole molecule, there were a number of isomers possible, and the examiner just wanted to know which isomer we thought we had. Well, this was a very difficult undertaking. It took us many, many years to establish. When we finally did establish it through crystallography, by that time it was around 1970 or so, and the patent only issued in 1974. So this was a remarkable situation. By 1969, we had already started selling Dialux, and we had patent protection on this technology until 1991.
Now, can I ask you a quick question? You said it was about 1970 when you were able to determine the structure.
Yeah.
Were you involved in determining the structure, or was it part of the team that was working on it?
It was our team. The way that was done in those days was that we had to grow a single crystal, and a crystallographer, in this case a man named Gunther Teufer, spent about $50,000 of computer time and many years working on that, and it was a very difficult problem. Nowadays there's technology for doing this much more efficiently and faster, but in those days it was a very slow process. So I think Festan was the one who grew the crystal, and then Teufer analyzed it. And the patent, of course, issued in Larry Festan's name, as it should have. And so that was important. And I think I mentioned yesterday that there are now about 1,900 patents that mention biomedicals in them. And the first 400 were almost all DuPont. And there were a couple of patents by other companies, but they were dominated by our position. So I think you can't overlook in industrial chemistry how important it is to get patent protection and to have a unique, when you have a unique system, because people always can nibble on the technology and find a way around it. Well, our technology was so solidly established that we had patents protection that was really outstanding. And, of course, particularly when you're a company that is relatively slow and methodical in bringing things to the market, it's good to have patents that last as long as possible.
And is patenting something management was pressing you to do, or is this an internal group decision?
No, the purpose of our research was to establish patentable products. A company like DuPont has to have strong patent protection on whatever it produces, because our products are generally very expensive because we have this enormous superstructure of marketing and research and all the other good things. So you can charge whatever you want if you have a good product that is patent protected. And nobody had anything that was as good as what we had, so we were in clover here. So that I think people underestimate the importance of patents. We fortunately did not. Well, I think we had sort of gotten there around to 1964 yesterday, and I think I mentioned that. Sescon and Korn and I had come up with an idea for employing the polymerization of a plasticizer to prevent color formation. And this system was called RF rigidification fixing. In other words, we wound up with a relatively fluid not liquid, but soft film where chemicals could react, but under some conditions we could stiffen this so that the interaction was reduced. And this created a great problem because Sescon and I thought this was much better than what we had before. And we thought we should push the research into a second generation product line, whereas our bosses thought we'd spend all this money, let's get a product out, and by the time we had developed this photopolymer fix system, another 2 or 3 years would go by, and they got impatient with us. So this caused a number of conflicts, to put it mildly, and in the end, we got permission to get develop this photopolymer-type system up to a point, but then everything was more or less diverted into the chemistry that we call McLaughlin's chemistry of photofix and so on. Well, in I mentioned to you also yesterday that we had sent one of our engineers to Lytton in California, and they held up a piece of our paper in front of a color cathode ray tube, and it formed color. Well, this intrigued everybody very much, not realizing that it was a very expensive tube and that we would have a long time before we could develop information recording from cathode ray tubes. However, politically, this was some technology that did not necessarily fall into the realm of photo products research or markets. And so our bosses said, well, let's see if we could do something here. And, well, in 1965 or so, DuPont was awash with money from having to divest itself of the General Motors stocks. So all of a sudden, a lot of research that had previously been underfunded suddenly got an enormous infusion of money. And what came out was DuPont called ventures. A venture was supposed to be a small company inside a large company that had its own marketing, its own manufacturing, its own research, and its own management. And there were 31 such ventures created in 1966. We were called the UVI venture, and we had at that time maybe 25 people working on it. As I think I told you yesterday, the optical printing using a machine that was developed for us by Data Communications Incorporated, that didn't fly, but all of a sudden the promise of using cathode ray tubes generated a great deal of enthusiasm. And my only problem was, I was happy that we were doing something. I was somewhat concerned that we were doing the wrong thing. And I felt as long as we had possibilities of using this light-sensitive paper for proofing, why don't we push that market, which existed, instead of using cathode ray tubes to image materials? Well, nevertheless, I was then put back into marketing, and I was told, try to make this go with cathode ray tubes. Well, it turned out, fortunately, we made some contacts with Boeing in Seattle, who were developing an information system whereby they would expose a piece of film on the faceplate of a cathode ray tube and then subsequently project that film on a large screen. In those days, cathode ray tubes for display were relatively small. I mean, the idea of having a 47-inch television set was something that you couldn't even dream of at that time. And the military wanted to have some displays where everybody could see the same image at the same time. This was called large wall screen display. And so Boeing invited us to come out to Seattle and demonstrate our materials. And they were very enthusiastic, and they begged us to help them on this. And there was another program at the down in Florida at the Apollo Research, which involved General Electric, and they similarly wanted to image things with a cathode ray tube. The only thing that worried me was that these were relatively small markets, and here we already had 25 people working to develop a product. And it turned out, technically, what Boeing did was fantastic. They had a build a situation room where it simulated the inside of a ship, and they projected film coming right out of a cathode ray tube, and it was great. But after they had accomplished that, their contract ran out, and that was the end of this program. Well, we had a couple of people who were great dreamers on this program, and one such man was a fellow named John Karras, who had worked on lasers and had been all around the DuPont company, and he decided he would call himself the product planner. And when I told Karras that this was that we had difficulties, he said, "Well, we got enough people; we could do anything." And he was very persuasive, and our whole program was directed at imaging things with cathode ray tubes. Unfortunately, there was no market for that. It took quite a while before that was realized. Another application that looked interesting at the time was barcodes. Litton Sweda had developed a point-of-sales system where a label that was magnetically encoded was used at the cash register to complete a transaction. And the folks at Litton felt that if we could optically print on top of the magnetic layer, that would make a very super label. And so they came to us, and we produced all sorts of label materials, which worked very satisfactorily. But then one day somebody at Litton Sweda decided to use a typewriter to generate information on top of the label, and it turned out that did not destroy the magnetic character beneath. So that project, after about a year or two, was also shelved. So we had problems that we came up with some very esoteric ideas for our technology, but the markets weren't there.
Was there any worry, I mean, internally on your team or maybe upper, that you were having these kinds of difficulties where there were seemingly limitless possibilities, but they were limited in scope?
Oh, yes. The company actually decided, remember, this was when computers were becoming fashionable, so the company decided they would have something called the Venture Simulator. And the Venture Simulator was a device by which somebody at the DuPont company could judge all these 31 ventures, how much money they were expending, how many people they had, what their competitive status was. I mean, all sorts of things. The only thing they didn't do was give us a market. And so I remember we had to list all the possible products that were product areas where our technology could fit. And I have the book still. I think there were 100 different things we could do. We thought we could make toys, we could, using it, we could make, do printing and so on, advertising, all sorts of stuff. And unfortunately, answering the questions that the venture simulator asked required 7 people working full-time. I mean, at that time, for instance, 3M had an interesting product called dry silver, which was not competitive with what we were doing, perhaps remotely so, but not near-term. And so we had to have 1 or 2 folks just spending time trying to figure out what could 3M do with this technology. I mean, here we were trying to figure out what to do with it, but we had to also figure out what our competitors were doing with technology that we didn't fully understand. I mean, this whole thing was idiotic, in my opinion. Well, we were organized into a marketing division, and we...
Still within the venture.
Within the venture. And our venture manager was a man named Lee Dumont, whom I had known for many years. He had been in Freon sales. And our marketing manager was a man named Irene DuPont May, who had also been in Freon sales. We had nobody in our organization who had any clue as to what we were doing technically. And this was somewhat embarrassing when we went out to visit other companies like IBM and RCA, who asked technical questions of our managers, who generally ducked in behind saying, "Well, this is all subject to patents and we can't talk about it." I remember on one occasion I was invited to give a talk at Bell Labs on photochromism, and It was just a wonderful experience. We started at 2 o'clock, then we broke for dinner, and then we continued until 9 o'clock in the evening. So these people were interested, and it was mostly because we could talk technical details. And then we went with our venture to present our imaging technology to their labs, and they asked us very logical questions like, what colors can you make, and what is the speed, and have you done this, and can you do that? And our venture manager kept on saying, well, this is all subject to patents, we can't talk about it. So one guy went out to lunch with us, and we were done in about an hour and a half. I mean, it was like being thrown out of Bell Labs. Mm-hmm. And so we had a problem that we were not well lit at the time by people who were not experienced in the field and who meant well, but we were competing, or we thought we were competing, with people who were experts in their field, and they refused to accept the fact that we wouldn't talk about things.
Well, now these managers that came from Freon, how long were they with you? They didn't. I guess I'm surprised that they didn't acquire some sort of expertise in the area that they're managing.
Well, you know, Ernie May was with us for about a year and a half, and Lee Dumont was with us for the entire venture. They had their tasks to fulfill, which was trying to get money for our project and manpower and so on. It was just that they did not have the perspective of where the business technically would go. And I mean, the one thing that has always bothered me about DuPont was because the company is in so many different businesses and people are supposed to grow, people were shifted from one area to another where they had no experience and had to make managerial decisions based on inexperience, in my opinion. And I think that hurt us. I mean, a company like Eastman Kodak, say, everybody was in the photographic business at that time. So if you had something new photographically, everybody in the management had some idea of where it would go. Whereas at DuPont, we were trying to tell a guy who was a Freon salesman what we should be doing in terms of the sensitivity of the material to certain lasers. So that, you know, it was not a good match. And we were muddling along, trying to interest people in our technology. And I mean, the good thing was that you could, in those days, if you said, my name is Ralph Disser and I work for DuPont, we have an interesting product that we'd like to show you, they would say, how soon can you come? I mean, it was people respected DuPont for innovation and so on. And
who else were you talking to in terms of talking about the technical details or talking about this for sales? I mean, you mentioned Bell Labs. You mentioned that you had done some work with Boeing and with GE as part of those ventures that didn't necessarily pan out.
You'd usually call somebody in research at another company and say, we have some technology that might have. And a good case in point was, I had always thought we ought to be able to come up with some kind of a toy using a light sensitive material. And so one day I called Mattel, which at that time was a very big manufacturer of toys, and I said I had an interesting material that might be useful for toys, and then we'd be going out to the West Coast a week later, and they said, well, if you'd like to come, send us a letter. We didn't have email in those days. When would you like to come? So, this was one of the most remarkable things that happened. Following morning, I get a phone call at about 11 o'clock, so it must have been 8 o'clock West Coast time, from a man who identified himself as Jack Ryan. And he said, Ralph, I hear you have some interesting thing. I said, well, I think so. He said, when can you come? I said, well, in a couple of weeks. He said, why don't you come this afternoon? I said, well, we have some plants and we want to visit some other companies and so on and so forth. And he said, well, I was going to go to something called Westcon, which was an electronics show where we thought we could meet some people who would be interested in imaging. So he said, well, what hotel are you staying in? And I told him. He said, that's not a very good hotel. I said, well, it's hard to get a hotel room in Los Angeles when Westcon is on. He said, we'll get you something. I'll have my secretary call you. So the following day, his secretary called and said, Mr. Ryan, we're sorry, there is no hotel available that he considers fit for you, so he'd like you to stay at his house. So I thought that was sort of an awkward situation where you're trying to sell somebody something and all of a sudden you're his house guest. So I asked my then leader, Ernie DuPont May, what I should do. He said, oh, well, if you get free lodging, why didn't you take it? I mean, he always felt his own money was involved in these transactions. So we got Mr. Ryan's address, and I was then married to my second wife, Nikki. And we flew out to Los Angeles, and we drove, and we got into a fabulous estate in Beverly Hills in Bel Air, which is a pretty nice neighborhood. And we were met by the estate manager who guided us to our rooms. Then the estate manager said, Mr. Ryan's secretary would like to talk to you. So Mr. Ryan's secretary turned out to be a former Miss Sweden. And she sat me down and said, what would you like to drink? I had a gin and tonic, and she handed out some papers and said, please fill these out, and we're an intelligence test. And I said, you do that with all your guests? And he said, well, Mr. Ryan likes to know whom he's talking to. So, well, later on I discovered that they had mixed me up with someone else. He said, no, we don't really. But he said, let me look at it anyway. He said, well, you're smart enough and you're nice enough to work at Mattel, but maybe you ought to consider that. And I said, well, I'm quite happy right now at DuPont. Anyway, he turned out to be an incredible man. He had been one of the inventors of the Barbie doll, and he was immensely rich. And an extraordinarily nice man. And so he had, at that time, he was separated from his wife who lived in another part of the building.
Yes.
And he had a crew of students from the University of Southern California, which was nearby, and they were running the household, cooking and cleaning and everything. And he got his tickets for a play that night, and we had a really nice time. Well, that was on a Saturday. On Monday morning, he and I, and another man from DuPont who managed to come out, went to give a talk, and it went over terrifically. We had a spray can with the Dilux solution, and Ryan had me spray his shirt, and then he put an image on his shirt, and he said, look what you can do with it. I mean, it was an absolutely great thing, and I went out there many times because it was always a pleasure living or staying with someone who was both friendly and very affluent. And then Mattel put on a group of people to work on UBI, it was still, or Dilux, it was just in transition. And after about a year and a half, I took my venture manager out to come up with a deal. And he said to Jack, that's all very good, but tell me, what are your projections for the first, fifth, and tenth year of sales? And Ryan said, Lee, if it's good, it's going to last 2 years. And in 5 years, we'd be on other toys. Mm-hmm. And DuPont said, well, that's not how DuPont likes to engage in product development. So that was the end of Mattel. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it was this kind of thing. I thought that if we could get started with something that didn't have very stringent requirements, I mean, toys were, I mean, environmentally they were okay, but, I mean, we were still not producing the highest quality consistent material in a toy that would have been okay. So we were confronted with this kind of thing over and over again. Well, and I must say our venture was muddling along and not doing too well. And then all of a sudden a man came into it whose name was John DeCampi. And John had been a Harvard MBA who had some experience in photographic research or products. And he made a very compelling argument how good this stuff was for proofing. We had earlier been pointed to proofing by some people in photoproducts, particularly a man named Larry Fryer, but the upper management of photoproducts didn't want to go into proofing, and Orkin couldn't go into proofing because it was officially designated as a graphic arts application, which would fall in the photoproducts realm. Well, John DeCampi did a good job. He was had a very nice presence. He must have been rich somewhere because he owned 6.5 Rolls Royces, old vintage cars.
Wow.
And at one time he was president of the Rolls Royce Club of America. So we joked. When people said, you deliver this in a Cadillac, we could say, no, we deliver our products in a Rolls Royce, which made for good jokes. Anyway, about a half a year after that, we had another impact that was very important. There was a man named Bill Wortel. And Bill Wortel was the most dynamic person I ever met at DuPont. And he became the new marketing manager after May had left us. And under Bill, things got organized. And he and I had great confidence in each other. And he got me promoted. He got me to spend 3 months in Europe looking for markets in Germany and England and France, Switzerland, Sweden. And it was a sheer pleasure working with that man. He had the leadership quality that made use of all the people he had working for him. And he solidly endorsed the idea that proofing would be our first market and that the other things would be peripheral. And we had discovered somewhere along the line that we could coat our product Dilux paper on both sides, which meant that you could make proofs which were two-sided, which pleased the market enormously. I forgot to mention that we had to give all this a name, and we were on many trips to the West Coast, and we had lots of time to have bull sessions. Usually be two or three of us going, and one day we were at a beach, at a restaurant in Laguna Beach, California, and we were having cocktails, and I said, then was Ernie May and Ted James who were with me, and I said, you know, we ought to do something useful when we're drinking. Why don't we come up with a name for UVI? We didn't want to call it. DuPont trade name should not really reflect what this material is doing. I mean, UVI would be ultraviolet imaging, and we wanted something that was different. So we talked around, and I came up with the name Dilux, and we couldn't find anything particularly wrong with it. And when we came back to Wilmington, then we plugged that into the system by which DuPont analyzes trade names, and nobody had ever come up with Dilux. We had had paints which were called Dulux, but nobody had come up with Dilux. And I thought Dilux was sort of light, Lux light, and dye was dyes. And that went through, and then we had a contest, but it was rigged, and they said, well, Ralph, you worked so hard on it, we ought to use whatever your name was. So I got the name Dilux. And so from then on, we became the Dilux Venture. Well, in 1969, in September, October, was a trade show in Chicago called the National Association of Photographic Lithographers or something like that. And we introduced Dilux paper there, and it was a big hit. And what was important, however, was people were enthusiastic about something that was dry, dimensionally stable, could be handled in ambient light, and gave off a blue color which was easy to correct with a black pencil rather than a black paper that was corrected with a blue pencil. So even the blue color was actually a plus. And
was that something that you had anticipated as you'd been working with it? Or was that
We had, particularly after John DeCampi joined the group. I mean, he knew something about proofing. My experience with graphic arts was sort of interesting. In the good old days, companies were much more lavish in entertaining each other. And at one point in about 1960 or so, I was in a group of six or seven people from DuPont who were invited by Meredith Publishing, who put out Better Homes and Gardens. And they showed us the entire process of printing, proofing, and everything. And their idea was they didn't have the research staff at Meredith to invent new products, but they felt if they alerted people in companies that had research capability, then they would maybe invent something that would be useful for the printing industry or for some other industry. So I knew a little, and I knew what a proof was in my days when you went to, when you graduated high school, there was a yearbook, and they would give you a bunch of pictures that would fade out eventually because they didn't want you to send these to your relatives. So these were bad proofs. Sorry, your facial characteristics. So anyway, I knew a little about it, but it was really John DeCampi who had this, and he obviously had learned something at Harvard. He knew how to present things. He and I had a great time going to these markets. Now, all along in this, we had to have brochures and other information to show off our materials. And I must say, they didn't always work perfectly. So I thought, well, the way to solve that problem was to make a movie and make a movie that would show what we could do with our technology.
So a promotional movie.
Promotional movie. And DuPont had a full-time movie photographer. His name was Franny Ryan. So he was intrigued, except, you know, he said, making a movie about a light-sensitive material is a bit of a challenge. And surprisingly, commercial Kodachrome was very, very slow. I mean, that's when you... And so we literally had to photograph that film, that movie, at night. I mean, he came out to the experimental station at midnight when the power consumption of the station was low, and we photographed this movie from midnight to about 4 o'clock in the morning. And ultimately, this movie was produced. It was 11 minutes long. We went to New York, and we had an announcer who had worked for DuPont, but was DuPont had a weekly radio show once called Cavalcade of America, and he read the text. I wrote the text, and he wrote the recorded it, and this movie we made had about 6 or 7 copies, and whenever we had somebody said, well, what does UVI or Dilux do? We sent them the copy of this movie. So that was actually a good idea. And for me, it was interesting. I enjoyed making movies, and I thought it was quite clever. And
Now, at this point, when you're making the promotional video and you are sending it to people, is most of your time kind of spent promoting Dilux and managing Dilux? You're not really in the lab anymore
Well, actually, I mean, I stopped actually doing lab work about 63 or so. I had a group of chemists working under me, and I was sort of trying to coordinate it. And one of my tasks was simply to identify people in the DuPont company who were not necessarily working on our project, but who could help us. And I mean, there were certainly people in plastics department and fabrics and finishes and so on who could help. And there was a lot of correspondence that had to be answered. I mean, people would ask, they heard about this, or they saw this, or saw that. And sometimes, we were looking for internal support. Now, one thing which was sort of along those lines was that came somewhat earlier, in about 1963. DuPont had a product called Corfam, which was to be shoe leather substitute or replacement. And one of the problems with Corfam was that it didn't stretch like a leather did. So if you bought a pair of Corfam shoes, they would never, if they were tight when you bought them, they were tight 5 years later. And so they were very concerned that people would always buy shoes and they'd be a little tight because they knew they would stretch. But Corfam didn't, so they were trying to come up with clever ideas of how to market Corfam. So one of the managers of fabrics and finishes department came and he said, well, there's going to be a World's Fair in New York in 1964-65, and if we could measure people's feet as they go through the DuPont pavilion, we could learn something about shoe sizes and people's feet. And so they came up with the idea that maybe we could make a silhouette of a person's foot. And so somebody built us a device where you stepped onto it, and there was a sheet of light sensitive paper underneath it and a bunch of ultraviolet lamps on top of it. And when after you stepped on it, the lights went on. And when you got off, there was a white silhouette of your feet. And they thought, well, if we find out what that person's shoe size was, then we could say, well, he buys size 8.5 shoes, and that's his foot image. So I got to be very knowledgeable in foot imaging, and this was a totally unscientific field. I mean, every shoe manufacturer had his own preferred code for sizing, and we were told that when they had something called a Brannock gauge, where you put your foot in it and they clamp it and figure out what your foot size is, and most of the time when they do that, they look into your shoe and see what size you already wear, and then they give you one that's a half a size larger to dry out. So I spent months learning about foot imaging and how we could fit our paper into that. Unfortunately, this gentleman died and foot imaging never became a product. But I mean, these things were peripheral, but they were interesting. Well, anyway, 1969, when Wortel took over management of the marketing group, all of a sudden things began to gel. We were selling materials, and one thing that happened then was slowly but surely Fortel products got interested in this chemistry. And then I found out that the biomidazoles were extraordinarily good photopolymerization initiators. And Fortel was developing a group of new markets in color proofing and in photoresist, where they needed a good photo initiator. And all of a sudden, they began to use our chemicals. And we transferred, Orchem made some money transferring chemicals to Fortel products and so on. Well, we kept on finding interesting markets. The military was interested in using our light-sensitive material to make contact prints of aerial reconnaissance negatives and the like. Anyway, it was sort of, we visited a great many army bases, Air Force installations, CIA, National Security Agency. I had a high military clearance, so we could go to these places. Mm-hmm. It was sort of interesting, and then we wound up with quite a respectable relationship with the U.S. Navy, and they wanted to spend money to develop color duplication film. So things were sailing along quite nicely, and we were beginning to be for real. And then the company decided they would move the Dilux venture to Fortel Products Department. which was a logical thing.
Who's moving you out of the Orchem? Moving out of Orchem?
Moving it out of Orchem. When we first heard about it, the message was it was lock, stock, and barrel. I mean, everybody. Then in reality, it came out that they took less than half of our group, and they purposely eliminated some of the people who were marketable, who were market specialists like myself and DeCampi. So all of a sudden, I was without this chemistry that I'd worked by then 10 years on and probably knew more about it than anybody else. And I traced that fact that they didn't take me due to some personal animosities. Fairly well documented that the guy who was the head of research in photoproducts was a man named Upson who felt that research was done by having somebody telling somebody what he should work on, not by someone like me who would endlessly come up with new ideas for developing this, expanding the technology. So I must say I was a little heartbroken at that point. And I wound up working again with Bill Remington, who I'd worked on when we started this thing. And we thought, well, what could we do that would be different? Well, somebody in Century Research had come up with an idea of using...
Before we start in on what you transition to, I think we should take a quick break because I need to use the restroom, if that's okay.
Pardon?
I need to use the restroom, if that's okay.